From KQED in San Francisco, this is the Writer's Block.
So I'm Ben Greenman. I'm an editor at The New Yorker magazine and also an author of fiction. I've published a number of collections of short fiction and a few novels. Today I'll be reading a story called Helpmate. And this is from a forthcoming collection called Correspondences, which is a series of stories about letters that either are letters or are about the dying art of letters or include letters in them in some form. And that book will be out in the fall by Hotel St. George Press, which is an independent press here in Brooklyn. I try, if possible, to only publish with independent presses in Brooklyn. And that, I'll just say one more thing about it. What we hope will happen is that the book will be not exactly a traditional book, but some sort of box that includes fragments of these correspondences. The genesis of this story, the little bit of setup that I'll give, and the genesis of this collection is that in past books, when I go around the country to read for them, and I stay in hotels, every once in a while I'll see a postcard that someone's left behind in the room or in the writing desk. I always get the pull the desk out to take the paper and the pens because, I don't know, it's my business. And I'll see a fragment of a letter that someone has left behind or a draft. So I started thinking about letters written from hotels and then particularly letters written that were unfinished or that weren't delivered in the way they were intended to be delivered. And this is one of the pieces that grew out of that initial idea. So this is called Helpmate, and I'm just going to read it now. Helpmate. Dear Susan, dear helpmate, dear wife, I beg your indulgence in this matter. Furthermore, I expect it. You have traveled this far with me. Come, let us travel on a little longer. Remember 1948? It was the year of everything for me and for you. It was the year of everything for us. How does everything come into being? One day we did not exist, and then we sprang into existence. As a learned man, I remembered how Athena came from the head of Zeus, but as a Christian, I accounted it a kind of genesis. What else was made that year? The mouth of the earth, the mouth of the well, the rainbow, fresh bread, the three trees in the front yard, and the first tongs. This requires some explanation. When you make tongs, you use tongs to lift the hot metal. Those lifting tongs, too, must have been forged. So how were they lifted? By other lifting tongs, of course. Follow it back and ask yourself, helpmate, how the first tongs were made. They were made by God in 1948 when we stood before him and became man and wife. I said what the preacher told me to say, but I heard other voices in my mind. One of them said something I will remember forever. I will call you Susan, and I will lay my hand on your brow, and I will love you, and I will promise to protect you always, and it will stir my heart. I did exactly that. I laid my hand on your brow. Do I need to tell you how beautiful you were those first few years? Sometimes I would get out of bed in the morning and pull back the sheets so that you were naked and just stand there looking at you. Who would have thought that one of the most beautiful women in the world could come from a small Nebraska town? You were the equal of any movie star. I have seen other women in this way, and they cannot compare. I am not proud of it, but this is no time for lies. I did not always walk straight along the path. In a hotel in Chicago in 1955, I started drinking with a group of baseball players. By then I was selling farm equipment. We had some money. I was using it to drink. The Braves were in town to play the Cubs, and some of them came to the bar of the hotel where I was staying. Not Hank Aaron, of course. He wasn't allowed. Not Warren Spahn. He was too old. But Eddie Matthews and Johnny Logan and Bob Buell and Bill Bruton and a few others. All of them had girls with them, and none of the girls were wearing wedding rings. I joined the group and we started to talk. One or two of the guys owned farms, and I had played baseball in high school, so we stood on that common ground. I was a second baseman like Danny O'Connell, who wasn't there. I wasn't good, but I wasn't bad, and I might have even had a little more power than O'Connell. I said that to the guys, and they took it right up, Eddie Matthews especially. He said, O'Connell couldn't hit it over the center field fence if there was a hurricane blowing out. Everyone laughed at Eddie Matthews' joke, even the girls. You don't not laugh at a guy like that. At one point, Bill Bruton went off to make a phone call, and when he came back, he said something unkind to one of the girls. She said something unkind in return, and bad weather sprung up between them. Bill Bruton stormed off, but the girl stayed. She was a beautiful girl. She had red hair, green eyes, a mermaid's complexion and figure. I trusted myself, as a man, to slide down the booth and close the gap between us. An hour or so later, she asked me if I would come up and help her fix something in her room. "Aren't you with Bruton?" I said. She told me the girls had their own room to share because the players shared rooms too. There was something to fix in the room, if you can believe it. It was a rod in the closet for coat hangers. I used the heel of my palm to hammer it back into the wall. "Thank you," she said. "What do I owe you?" She laughed at my expression. "It's like you were actually figuring the price," she said. She asked if she could get me another drink. She went for ice with tongs. I took the drink. My head was swimming. I hope that it does not reflect badly on me to say that she kissed me first. I could not have unbuckled my pants on my own. When I left the room a few hours after that, Bill Bruton's girl was stretched out on the bed. She looked lovely, but she didn't look like you, Susan. We had a baby, you and I. We had another baby. Both were brought out with tongs. I loved the babies. I held them in my arms. I waited for the love to spread outward so that I would love you too in the fashion you deserved. Once I sat on an airplane and I thought about leaving you, I had met a woman and fallen in love. I shut my eyes tight and my hunger for her eventually passed. The plane bounced violently in the air and a woman behind me called for Jesus with what was probably fear but sounded like ecstasy. Have I lost the thread? Let me pick it up. Life has been a struggle since I rose into adulthood. There was a period when I was a young man when I felt that I was winning that struggle. But now I feel there is no such thing as winning. The more flesh, the more worms. The more possessions, the more anxiety. The more women, the more witchcraft. The more maidservants, the more lewdness. The more manservants, the more theft. Last night I sat at the desk as you lay sleeping and started to write this note. I threw away the first draft and the second. I began a third that was too sentimental. Dear Susan, whom I love with all my heart. Then I did away with it all and got into the car and came to the mountains. The car is a Stutz Bearcat, a 1935 that I got from a man who owned a farm upstate. I had sold him a McCormick Farmall 400, a beautiful tractor. He was so proud of it that he called his son out to take a look. His son was 12 or maybe a little younger. He was still sweet. He hugged his father and told him that it was even better than the Bearcat. My ears went up. You have a Bearcat? He laughed. It's not in the bloom of its youth. It's been in a barn for 10 years, doing nothing much. I asked if it was for sale. If you like it, he said, it's for sale to you. That was 1958. I went through Lincoln in my Bearcat like a king. I remember thinking that night that I had crossed paths with Charlie Starkweather, who was tearing out of town in his hot rod on his way to getting dead in Wyoming. He was 12 years younger than me, Charlie, though his birthday was only a day off. He was November 24th, and I was November 25th, same day as Joe DiMaggio. My mother knew a woman who knew the family and thought they were fine, upstanding people. The Starkweathers, that is, not the DiMaggios. Last night I got in the car and did away with it all. What exactly is my plan? How do I live? What kind of man am I? Or better, Susan, let me ask this way. What kind of man am I when I am not around you, when I am not around my son? Was it Frank who ran out and hugged me by the tractor, or was it another man and another son? I have time to answer this question. I am up here in the mountains, my head clearing, my head clouding, and I am managing the relationship between the two, clear and cloud, with a bit of magic that I found stashed underneath the seat in the car. I stashed it there. It is whiskey, and if there is anything richer than its glow, I do not know it. I am dreaming of dropping a few cubes of ice into a glass. The man who sold me the Stutz Bearcat died of drink in 1959. It comes around. Am I married? I am to you, and every day my heart gladdens when I think of it. There were other girls I could have married. There was an Abigail, a divorcee who smoked too much. There was a Beatrice who was taken by cancer early. There was a Lorna whose father owned car dealerships in Omaha and Lincoln. She was a hot little coupe of a thing who came on strong one summer when I was 19. She would have had me except that there was something vampiric about her. She would take your energy when she touched or kissed you, and if you got her clothes off, it was even worse. I used to drop her off at her father's house and wonder how I would find my health again. And yet her father wished for me to have her hand. He saw something in me that conveyed a sense of promise. This is why the marriage advice of a rich man should never be heeded. I should have listened to my own father instead. He was poor. He suffered from distress of mind throughout his life, and it was several times made worse by melancholy events. When I was 7, my mother had a baby girl who died in the crib at 6 weeks. When I was 9, my father lost some property in a flood and was fleeced by dishonest insurance men. He had moments of joy, but they were rare, so rare that they only led me to understand the depth of his melancholy. When I was 11, he came running out of the house with the newspaper in his hand. "He did it," he said. "He did it." He was Waldo Waterman, one of my father's heroes. Waterman was an aviator and an inventor. He had labored for more than 20 years on a tailless aircraft he called the What's-His. He shelved the designs. He took them down from the shelf. He dreamed and woke from his dreams. I think my father found something in Waterman's story to hold on to. In 1934, the U.S. Bureau of Air Commerce called in competition for a low-cost airplane that could be owned the way an automobile was owned, one in every garage. Waterman, who had brought things along with the What's-His, got back to his laboratory and built the aeroplane, which evolved into the Aerobeal. It was the Aerobeal that the papers were writing about that day that my father came running out of the house with the newspaper in his hand. The Aerobeal had enjoyed a flawless test flight. It did not spin. It did not stall. All that stood between it and mass production was its price. The Bureau of Air Commerce wanted a device that came in around $700, and the Aerobeal's cost was roughly 4 times that. "He'll bring the cost down," my father said. "This is Waldo Waterman we're talking about. He has energy to spare." My father was wrong about this. Waterman fell ill the following year, and his company had to close its doors. This sent my father into a deep well of sorrow. He spun. He stalled. And then, in 1939, he hanged himself with a belt in the barn of our farm. I didn't see them cut him down, but I heard him fall to the floor of the barn. It was the lowest note on the piano. I remember my mother crying. I remember my grandmother crying. I remember saying something that I didn't know I would say. "Why did he do it?" I said. "I don't agree with him at all." As I have grown older, I have found that this disagreement with my father is not so clear. He believed that pain was not to be endured, not when it could safely be avoided. I remember that he went once to the dentist for an abscess. He was cured, but for weeks he kept touching his face at the spot where the rotten tooth had been. "What are you doing?" I asked him. I was 9 or 10. "I'm trying to make sure there is not more pain," he said. "I don't feel any, but it's just like pain to pretend that it's gone and then spring up and surprise you." I thought he was joking. I will write my father's name in triplicate to verify the similarities between us. William, William, William. In 1956, I found myself removing the pencil skirt and cotton panties of a young woman who worked with me at what was then B&R Farm Equipment. This was a short Irish girl, a real Colleen. In my desk, I kept a number of bottles filled with special liquids that made the office seem like a place where a winning game might be played. I plied her with drink and praise until she was like a penny rolling across the floor. At that time, I had tongs and ice. "Let me get you some of those babies," I said as I clinked the cubes into her glass. 1, 2, 3. We retired to a small room off the main office. I kept a cot in there. We collapsed desperately against one another on the cot, and I removed just what I have said I removed, pencil skirt, panties. She had shaved herself bare, which was shocking in those days. It suggested wantonness. Afterwards, she said, "Was that lovemaking?" And I said, "If it wasn't, it was something nearby." And she said, "Why did you keep touching your face?" And I said, "I didn't know I did." She turned away and I stroked the back of her head. the ragged line where the hair rose off the neck. She had muscles in her upper back, and I was suddenly ashamed of my own weakness, and I became sad enough to cry, though I did not do so. That night, when I came home, I told you that I didn't think I was learning from my life any longer, and you said that it was a peculiar thing to say, and I agreed. But I lied. I had learned plenty from my life, though not from my home. Knowledge is pain, even in small doses, and the idea that I might learn more from these women, in a hotel in Chicago, in a room off the main office, well, that did me in by degrees, long before I came out to the mountains. Is there any way to safely experience conscience in such a manner that it does not become corrosive guilt? This is not a question that you would expect from me, Susan. You think of me as the boy who leapt from youth into manhood, armed only with his temper, with jealousy, with good work habits and a line of credit from Sable Bank and Trust. But time has changed me, Susan. All has been remade. Genesis has turned to Exodus, has turned to Leviticus. Do you understand me? I cannot endure a person who does not understand what I am saying, no more than I can endure an empty bottle. At my time of life, Susan, it cannot be supposed that I have much energy to spare. Forever yours, nevermore, William. To subscribe to the Writer's Block and hear more stories, please visit www.kqed.org/writersblock.
The Writer's Block is produced by KQED.